When was the last time you refreshed your bedding? Sleep cooler with Avocado's naturally breathable, certified organic sheets. Choose from GOTS-certified organic cotton, linen, or hemp, all made-safe certified to the highest standards of non-toxic safety, delivering the ultimate in luxury, sustainability, and style, and a deeper, more restorative sleep. Join Avocado's mission to be one of the world's most sustainable brands at avocadomattress.com.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
All right. Welcome back to Friends from Work, co-creator of Ben 10, writer of Superman, JLA, Deadpool, and Spider-Man, Joe Kelly. Thanks
Hello.
For coming back on, Joe.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. I think in recent memory, this is definitely the first like repeat performance I've done. I don't know if I've...
Okay.
Yeah, a repeat guest for other people. So thanks for having me back.
Oh man, no, we're honored. It's funny because the timing, you know, we talked in July last, I think. And it can't have been long after that that Eight Deaths of Spider-Man was announced. And so, you know, we had talked a bit about Spider-Man in the context of that or in that conversation, but obviously it was more of a Deadpool focused talk. And so I remember you saying when we last talked that Spider-Man is your all-time favorite superhero, and we have that in common. So whenever I saw that you were coming back on just for a bridge, what I thought was a bridge run there, was exciting for me. And then, you know, once the announcement came out that you were going to be on the new volume of Amazing Spider-Man, that was very exciting.
Oh, well, thanks. I'm very glad. It was exciting for me too. And it was also a surprise to me that it was not a bridge. That's, you know, the crazy, you know, mini origin story of this whole thing was that I'd been asked to do the Eight Deaths story, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. And I had been working on that probably, you know, a couple of months before I spoke to you last time. And then, we had a Marvel summit. And I got invited to the summit, which was cool. It just worked out well, you know, that I happened to be there. And it was really obvious that they didn't have like the next person yet, you know, like they didn't know who was following up Zeb. And I was, you know, I had a nice time in the room with everybody and I felt like I contributed. And I was like, is this a terrible idea, but should I pitch myself for this, you know, taking over Amazing? And Nick is like, I don't hate that idea, which is always like a, you know, ringing endorsement.
Yeah. Nick, Nick Lowe.
Yeah, Nick Lowe and editor supreme. And he, so he ran up the flagpole and I guess other people didn't hate it. And then we decided to give it a shot. And, you know, in part, I haven't done a monthly in a long time, mostly due to the nature of the animation business. You know, just I never felt like I could take on that kind of a commitment.
Yeah.
And, you know, right now, as you may or may not know, the animation business is in all sorts of crazy shenanigans. So yeah, it's kind of the ideal time to do a monthly and sort of see what's up. And it's been great. So, you know, we had to shift gears on Eight Deaths. And that's when we got, you know, Justine Ireland to come in and help out. And she did an amazing job because she basically was helping build the boat while it was in the water, you know, because I had most of the story figured out, but I didn't have all the, you know, nuts and bolts because I was like, oh, yeah, I'll get to it when I get to it. And all of a sudden now I had to, you know, pass the ball to somebody else. So, you know, she did a very, you know, stellar job and was super pro, you know.
Yeah, I feel like y'all's styles complemented each other well in that, I mean, obviously it's, y'all both had sections of issues that were bombastic and funny and big, and also some more like introvert or introspective moments. But I did think that it was kind of a nice like passing a baton each time to kind of get to a different section of the story, and to maybe just different instincts from both of y'all, I think covered a lot of ground that maybe you wouldn't have thought to cover if you were just at the helm for the entire thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah. 100%. And yeah, she was really great, especially with, you know, the relationship stuff. I mean, there were elements of that story where we knew we wanted Peter to be in a pretty conflicted place and maybe not fully behaving in the way that we're accustomed to seeing. We've seen him juggle relationships and stuff before, but because of the sort of dark nature of that story, it was a little bit different. And she was really good about being like, if he does X, he's troubled. If he does Y, he's a dick. And we just were like, good. We don't want the dick part. So thank you for that perspective, you know? And so she was great with that and really helped chart that stuff. And and she was awesome. Yeah. So it worked out really well.
Well, you know, it's also nice there that you have, you're coming in as someone with a lot of Spider-Man experience, and we'll talk about that in a second. But, Justina is someone that I think had written, I don't know what the timing is on that. I know she wrote like a Blood Hunt tie-in for Amazing Spider-Man. So she wasn't new to the book, but I think it's probably helpful to have that different perspective also.
Absolutely. And I mean, she's a novelist. I mean, she's done plenty of work. Sometimes you get somebody who's like new-ish to comics, even though she's been in the industry for a little bit of time, but she has been a writer for, for a long time. So it was an easy yes to work with her.
Well, talking about you having a lot of experience with Spider-Man you saying that he is your favorite kind of all-time superhero. I mean, that's a bold statement coming from someone that has written Superman. I agree with you, and I also love Superman. But I was curious, what was your introduction to Spider-Man as a character? Was it an animated show, or did you start with the comics from the get-go?
Yeah, I think I really think that my probably literal first time ever seeing him was on The Electric Company, which I'm sure predates your wife. Is a PBS show, and it was like a silent segment that was narrated by Morgan Freeman. Crazy like early job of Morgan Freeman's.
I did not know that. That's fun.
Yeah, it's great. When you go back and hear it, you're like, oh my God, it's young Morgan
Freeman. Wow.
But that was probably my first like visual intro, or non-comics intro. And then the old cartoon, they were rerunning forever. Mm-hmm. It was just in syndication forever. So it was that 60s cartoon.
Yeah.
And that would have been, when I was aware of it, it was in the early 70s. And then, but the comics, like I was given this box of comics by my uncle, and it actually had a lot of DC in it. It had a lot of Superman, a lot of war books, horror books, which the horror books were very fundamental for me. Like they really became a sort of cornerstone of stuff I was interested in, Witching Hour and House of Secrets and House of Mystery.
Yeah. But
the only Marvel books he had were Spider-Man. And I, just read the hell out of those books. And so, I dug him as a kid. He was just, he's such a bombastic character. He's such a colorful character. The action is always so cool. The powers are so fantastic. And oddly, it's funny you mentioned Superman. Like I do love Superman. Like, and I came to love Superman after writing him, for a bunch of years. Much more than I did as a kid. I liked him fine, and that the first Richard Donner movie was formative. It's outstanding. It still holds up for what a hero can be. But Peter being so kind of like always troubled and always screwing up and always worried, I think the worry, maybe the worry and the guilt, like those are things that even as a young person, I was able to understand, you know? And you didn't see that coming from Superman, right? He's just sort of moving through his adventures and he's worried about Lois, or he's worried about making sure people aren't hurt, but it's like superhero stuff. It's not the human stuff, at least not in the books at that time, in the books that I had was given in this box. You know, I don't want to disparage anybody's writing. It's just, that was not how I perceived that character. But Spidey was like, you know, you could be Spidey. Like it didn't seem like that big of a leap to go, oh yeah, if I get bit by a spider, this is it. Like, yeah. I'd be that dude.
It is funny. My wife, and she does not mean this as a compliment, but whenever, when we're watching a Spider-Man movie, or I'm telling her about a comic that I'm reading, every time the kind of Spider-Man guilt complex comes up, she's like, you know, I would never guess that this is the most formative character for you. Just the, like, it is funny. The folks that, I think it's maybe people that are very interior or, I mean, because that's the other appeal of Spider-Man for me in large part, you know, those kind of swinging around the city, just like overthinking everything sequences that I feel like go all the way back to the Ditko days.
Oh yeah.
There's something that is just weirdly, it's funny because obviously swinging around the city is a very not relatable, like fantastic thing, but there's something about that, like those scenes that ground the character because of the way that he's been written there. And I loved noting that in the first couple of issues of the new run here, you've got several moments like that kind of baked in that feel very of that kind of classic model.
Right. I mean, it, for me, that's the DNA, right, of this character. It's just, if you don't have a Spidey who's struggling to balance life with superheroing, it doesn't feel right to me, you know, like that's, and there, you know, there's always like, we did, like when we did Nonstop Spider-Man, like the sort of pitch of that when Nick and I talked about it, he was like, I want to do like 24, but as a Spider-Man book, I just want to, what if we just had, you know, it was meant to be 12 issues and then there was, you know, COVID, but it was like, you know, 12 issues, one adventure, like each issue is like an hour, like let's just do it, you know?
Yeah.
And in that, there's not a ton of room. Like there's a little bit of flashback to just sort of set up the characters and acknowledge the cast, but it was like, no, that was meant to be like all action and all fun. But in a normal story, I feel like, and I've seen a lot of this, I did an Ask Me Anything recently, and a lot of comments or a lot of questions were just about the cast. You know, people just, even not even necessarily their specific favorites. It was just, oh, are you going to address the cast? Are you going to have normal person problems? So a significant number of people, like I would say like almost, I don't know, 20% of this like 100 questions were about the cast. I mean, it was not insignificant, which was great. Cause I think that is the appeal, you know, it's part of how, I think that's how he works best, and he works best in the movies that way, you know, every time, any other media, not just.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's funny that's, it makes sense. That's what folks gravitated towards. Because I do think there has been a tendency, and not, I won't pick on the Spider-Man office, because I feel like this is across, certainly across a lot of Marvel books and DC books. And I just think superhero comics in general, it's like eventually when you have these properties running for so long, you start to see normally just one character at a time. It's not like any one writer is overdoing it, but you see like, you know, Flash becomes Venom and Harry has become the Green Goblin. You know, obviously that was a long time ago, but there's a point where it's now almost every person in Peter's life that used to be that used to be the kind of grounding normal people that he had to hide his superhero persona from, have all kind of gotten either superhero or supervillain like treatment. And so it's, I think it's kind of, it's hard to maintain that kind of Romita era coffee bean thing when everyone has gone through these, like, you know, physical transformations or like gone to literal hell and come back. And it's like, so I do think it's, you know, it's a fair question, I guess, as you're coming in, if people are kind of looking for something like that.
Yeah. And there's a, you know, there's a tightrope that you wind up walking between new characters and established characters, right? In the supporting cast, because the, you know, we were just talking about this the other night. You know, the fact that Marvel has never really done a hard reboot of their universe is really cool. It, and I've always appreciated that, you know, like I've been the beneficiary of new, you know, reboot elements when I was at DC, and I've seen what it's like to not have them. And sort of my preference, I would say that my preference as a fan is the non-reboot, because I just, I love that it like, it all counts, right?
Yeah.
But that, but it comes with, and I did air quotes in case you're just autoing audio. But the trade-off is that you have to figure out how to make that stuff work. And so you wind up doing, sometimes people do soft reboots, or sometimes you just have to sort of wave the magic wand and just go, well, it's Marvel time. So it gets stretchy, and it becomes challenging with stuff like, you know, what wars was Cap in and all that kind of stuff, right? It gets, it can be a bit nutty, but as long as everybody's sort of like in the same boat, and the, and by that, I mean the readers and the creators, like we're all in it together. And we're like, yeah, we love these characters. We're going to be okay with Peter has had, you know, 77 Christmases, and you know, it is what it is. And we're going to just be okay with that. I think as long as people are in that spirit, then we can, you know, then you can play, like you can have more fun with the cast, and you can have somebody who, it's like soap opera 101, right? It's like, you know, somebody died and they came back and they don't remember, and it was their twin brother, and you know, all that sort of chaos. It works in melodrama. It's fun. And we do a lot of melodrama, you know?
No, I mean, that's a good point. And I do, you know, obviously, the kind of famous Stanleyism about every comic being someone's first, I think creates a really interesting, to me, interesting in the results, because it kind of creates some creative constraints where you need to both account for the continuity for people that are like me and have read, you know, almost every issue of Amazing Spider-Man at this point over the course of my life, and people that are just picking up this new book because it's Amazing Spider-Man number one, and they want to start at the beginning of something, that because you don't want to burden them with continuity that they don't understand and can't understand without going and reading like a Marvel Wiki page.
Right.
But you also don't want to turn off the people that that feel like that stuff counts and it does matter, and you want to see it impact Peter in some legitimate way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that is the biggest challenge. I mean, because it's, you know, people get emotionally invested in the characters, and I totally get that. It's what we want, you know, and it's the great joy of doing this kind of work is when somebody's like, oh yeah, that story and what you did with that character really meant something to me. You know, it's the big gift. And, you know, then the double-edged sword is like, yeah, people care about these characters. So, you know, I come in brand new, and then I'm sort of dealing with the consequences of something that happened, forget about 16 years ago, you know, 60 years ago, right? Yeah. It's a really interesting puzzle. And like I said, I wouldn't even say it's like a question of good actors or bad actors, but it's like the people who read the book and sort of have grown up with it and are just like, yeah, I get it. This is what happens sometimes. Comics can be weird. Like, it's okay. I think they tend to have a little bit of a better time just in terms of enjoying things and kind of going like, yeah, okay, I get what the, you know, I get that this is the spirit of what we're, you know, the adventure we're trying to weave here, as opposed to being like, I have to have this all logically make sense. Because for me, then once you start pulling on the sweater, it's like, okay, you know, you're not going to buy this thing, but you're going to buy a guy that sticks to walls. Like, it's too easy to unravel the whole thing. So for me, it all just comes with the dinner, and it's fine. You know, like it's, I appreciate that people are very passionate about these characters. Like it, I am. I mean, yeah, like yeah. I care about them, you know?
You know, I think Chip Zdarsky, in talking about his Daredevil run, he talked about the way he approaches this as a creator. And I think he was saying he sort of has looked at it this way as a reader also, which is like, yes, all of these things happen to Daredevil, but also, you know, you kind of have to, you pick the pieces that work for your story and you focus on those and you tease those out. And it's not that you're trying to undo anything prior or that you're directly contradicting it, but you can't. Yeah. If you tried to be in the business of juggling all of that stuff, it would kind of be a nonsense book.
Yeah.
So I think
100%. And yeah, Chip and I have talked about this quite a bit, and it's a no-win proposition. And it doesn't, not just in terms of trying to keep people happy, but it's like the job becomes so unwieldy at that point that really, what are you getting? Like you would get, you know, it's fine. I was just looking at pages from the Spidey Godzilla book. And
oh man,
because it's set in the 80s. I sort of like, I looked at a bunch of comics from that time and I sort of put in a ton of like editorial caption boxes.
Oh, I love
some
that.
Some referencing real comics, some referencing other ones that don't exist. And there's a ton, there's thought balloons in it. You know, like it's all, you know, it's super fun. It's of the time. You would get a comic that was like 3 pages and then all of it would just be notes explaining all the other things, right? If you had to worry about continuity to that depth. So it's like, yeah, you know, you take what works. Hopefully everybody goes along for the ride. Yeah. Some people are going to be like, oh, what about that thing that I love that also works?
Yeah.
And it's going to show up some other time. You know, it's, yeah, we probably talked about this last time, but you know, One Piece is like very near and dear to my heart.
Oh, yeah.
Introduced to me by my son, and you know, I'm caught up, completely caught up. And
that's impressive.
Yeah, you know, yes and no. I mean, it's you know, 1200 chapters, but you can get to it.
That's true. Yeah,
especially if you enjoy it, and I really do. And the thing that, you know, you go, okay, this is a at the moment 25-year-old story that's been written and drawn by the same person for all that time. It certainly it ballooned out from what he originally thought it was going to be, but he's got to keep track of hundreds of characters, you know, And this is all of his own creation. It's not like he picked it up from somebody else or nobody else is going to come in after him and go, well, I'm going to just tell this part. I mean, somebody might get a little spinoff or they have those projects, but nobody's just going to go like, oh, we're rebooting One Piece and here we go. Like it'll never happen. So you just picture that challenge. Now multiply that by 3 years, you know, or 3 times the number of years worth of stuff. And now you're getting close to Spider-Man numbers.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot. So you have to, you know, you have to go in and just kind of put the blinders up and go, what is the story I'm trying to tell? And what do I believe suits the character best with the assumption that other people believe that as well?
Yeah. Which, yeah, I think in that, seems to me to be the only way to approach it in good faith. I was curious, you know, you, I think, and I could be wrong here, your first full issue of Amazing Spider-Man was 565, I think.
Could be. Honestly, I don't know the numbers.
Yeah, I was looking back through my Brand New Day issues. But I was also thinking, you know, you at that point had been writing for Marvel for at least 10 years or so. I'm trying to think back when the Deadpool stuff started. And
yeah, I mean, off and on, just Deadpool and the X-Men, that all started in 97 pretty much.
Okay.
So, you know, I had kind of started, because that was also when I graduated school. So I was like, I graduated grad school, got the X-Men, got married all in the same summer. And
wow.
So it was a big year. and then Spidey came later, you know, like I had already gone to DC for a while. I had done a bunch of stuff. I'd worked with Steve Wacker, you know, Steve was back at Marvel, you know, so it was sort of following things back and forth. So yeah, then I got to be, you know, part of that crew, that was working on those stories. And yeah, it was awesome. I mean, it was a great and a very different experience than it is now, just because it was a whole bunch of us.
Yeah.
Which is a lot more, honestly, what I've been used to for most of my career, because even on a book where it was like, yeah, I'm the writer of Action Comics, but it's like, there were three other people doing the other books in the Superman, you know, triangle era. And so right. We'd get together and we'd hash out, what does a year look like? And you had people to bounce stuff off of, other writers, not just your editor. And that's how it was first time around with Spidey. And this is obviously different.
I would think that probably played to your strengths as a TV writer too, right?
Yeah, I really love writers' rooms. I really do. It's mm-hmm. I find it incredibly fun. I find it super inspirational. Like, you know, even when people are butting heads a little bit, as long as you don't have, you know, what you would call an assassin in the room, which is like the person who just craps on everybody's ideas instantly. It's like, well, that can't work because of X, Y, and Z. Like, I don't, that's, it's like the living embodiment of the Simpsons comic shop guy. Like, I don't, right. That's not who you want in the room. And I've been lucky that generally we don't get that. So it's a really fun way to keep you on your toes, get a bunch of ideas going. Everybody sort of approaches story slightly differently, but you all have the same vocabulary, you know? So you can talk about, oh yeah, in this act, this should happen X, Y, and Z, but everyone has like a slightly different sense of what that means. And the tension of that brings out some cool stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is such the Brand New Day era, at least from the outside, is such a unique one within Spider-Man. I mean, because it was what, shipping three times a month? Was that the
cadence? I don't remember if it was three times or if it was weekly, but it was pretty.
Yeah, it might have been weekly. But you know, you've got, there are a ton of plot lines that you're juggling, although obviously, you know, you have certain writers and artists on certain issues. But what was it like? You know, I associate you so much with that era, because I think, as I said last time, as I was reading through that stuff, it was always fun for me to read an issue first and then see if I could guess who the writer was. and the way that I first learned your name was because so many of the issues that I really liked in the Brand New Day run were yours.
Oh, thank you.
It was it always in my mind, like, you're part of the, you know, part of the Spidey brain trust from the very beginning. But it was, I think, you know, 20 issues or so before you showed up with, I think the first one was the Hammerhead issue with Chris. What was it like kind of coming into that and finding a voice for Peter Parker on the fly when, you know, that's a character that I think maybe of any superhero in superhero comics has the most recognizable voice?
It was a great room to come into. Everybody was really cool, you know, like it, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, Dan Slott is like an idea machine and has probably the most enthusiasm of anybody I've ever met in comics. loves it.
And loves Spider-Man. Legitimately loves Spider-Man.
Yeah. I mean, and he was great. So everybody was super welcoming, and you know, Zeb and I got along great, you know, in that time. And I'm trying to think about, you know, Bob Gale was just super cool to have him there and to be like, oh yeah, Back to the Future. Like,
yeah, that is
sick. You know,
it was kind of, and Mark Waid was in that crew as well.
Mark was there, right? And Mark Guggenheim. And Guggenheim and I have been friends for, you know, since then. I mean, you know, it was just a good room, you know, like it was a good bunch of people that really wanted to do cool stuff. And, you know, it wasn't hard in terms of like finding the voice. Cause I think him being my favorite, it was just like, there are some characters where I feel like you have to really dial in intellectually, does this work or does this not work? And then there are characters you have a gut for. And for me, the way I write Spider-Man, there's a lot of gut involved, you know, like my brain kicks in when I have to figure out plot and stuff, but not when it comes to his voice or the humor or the pathos. Like, that stuff feels right to me. Cause it's so much of what I grew up reading and consuming, right? You know?
And it is a relatable character. So I can imagine it's like, I would think it would be a lot more difficult to compellingly write like Thor. Right. In terms of getting into that headspace.
Yes. That would be a big challenge for me. Yeah, Thor's a great example. You know, like I've gotten to know Al Ewing a little bit recently, you know, from the summit. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, you know, and I've read some of those books and I really like what he does.
I love his Thor book.
Yeah, and I'm like, my brain does not do that. You know, like I would have to do a lot of work to figure, like, it would be fun for a short period of time. I think I'd be like, all right, cool. I want to do a Viking story and this will be awesome. But it's not how I'm wired, you know? Mm-hmm. So that would be a real challenge. I'd have to think very differently. It's sort of like the gag where it was, you know, every once in a while you get a chance to write like Reed Richards or somebody who's like the smartest person in the Marvel Universe. And I'm like, yeah, I'm so not that smart. So you have to like figure out how to fake your way into being smarter than you are. It's very fun, you know, an exercise in humility as well when you realize how little you know.
It's funny to me. We were talking about this the other day. You know, the difference between like a Stan Lee Reed Richards and a Jonathan Hickman Reed Richards, where Stan would just, everything was just some kind of cosmic energy, and that was all that he needed to do. And then, you know, Jack would draw something insane that like got you the rest of the way. But, you know, Hickman he's going to go and pick apart everything he can and try to apply as much real science to it as he can. And yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, it's also one of the reasons that I think it's so cool to have you and Hickman writing the kind of, you know, these two parallel Spider-Man books at the same time, because I feel like y'all have such different sensibilities.
Oh, for sure. And I again, John, I've only really gotten to know Jonathan a little bit in the last year. And I like him a lot just as a guy. Like, we, you know, hung out a couple of times, and he's super smart. He's very awesome. He's really direct, which I appreciate. Like, he's got like a no BS kind of way about him, but it's kind though. Like, he's not that assassin in the room. Like, he asks these questions that are like, hey, I'm just trying to get there quick. You know, like, what are you trying to do? And it's awesome, you know, and I love it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's somebody, you know, everybody in those rooms, you can learn a lot from, you know, whether you write similarly or not. And he's somebody that you can learn a ton from. But it is funny. It reminds me of, you know, when I was going to school, one of my teachers, he was like a, you know, special guest professor. Was this guy named Lorenzo Semple. And Lorenzo, he was the creator of the original Batman 66 show.
Oh, wow. So
he was like a living legend, right? And he had also done some serious movies. He'd done like Papillon but also did the Flash Gordon movie, right? Like, all this crazy stuff. Had a wild career. Wow. He told us a story once where people would ask him how they would like write Batman to be so smart. They're like, you know, the Riddler comes up with all these crazy riddles and Batman figures it out. Like, how do you do that? Do you sit there and you have to figure all this stuff out? And he would just say, there's a really easy secret to that. He goes, you throw anything you want. You can make the most nonsensical Riddler puzzle. Doesn't matter. As long as Batman says there can only be one answer, and then he tells you what the answer is, it's like, then he's the smartest guy in the room. And once you realize that trick exists, it's everywhere, like everywhere. Huh. It was amazing. And obviously that's, you know, it's a comedy. It was a comedy adventure show, whatever. But to the people, certainly of the time period too, you know, it was tongue in cheek and it was campy and people knew it, but then there were people that were really on board with it. And they were like, oh yeah, you must be super smart. Even if just in terms of coming up with riddles, like even if it's just at that level. And it's like, yeah, we would just say a bunch of nonsense. And they go, well, there can only be one answer. It's that's the really water funny. Tower. And you'd be like, okay.
I mean, that's in the DNA of the Bruce Timm Batman show. That's in, I mean, that's in superhero comics. And
yeah,
I mean, I was, my real introduction to Spider-Man was the 90s show that John Semper did. And there's a ton of that in there too. You know, it's like the, let's triangulate this. And
right.
As a kid, I had no idea what that meant. All I knew was that they were pressing a button and suddenly there was a tracker that led them exactly where they right. needed to go. It's funny.
Because really we don't care, right? Like at right. the end, sometimes we do. Like if there's a cool, you know, a character like a Sherlock, I right. want to see those connections and I want to go, oh yeah, if I was a super smart observant person, I could have figured that out. Or like a really good Batman mystery. Like yeah. I want that out of that. And then there are times where I'm like, no, I really don't care. Like I just want it to be fun. I want mm-hmm. to get to the heart primarily, you know, and if the plot is interfering with the heart, then I'll check out, you know, if it's the wrong kind of story for me.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah, it is. It's funny. I was rereading Batman Year One recently. I'm not going to go on a Batman tangent, but it cracks me up every time I read the introduction from Frank Miller, where he's so mad that 60s TV series existed. he's got to right the wrong, which, you know, everyone loves Year One. It's an incredible book.
Yeah.
But it is always funny where it's like, I think that these can both exist. I'm okay with them both existing.
It's a beautiful thing about Batman. Like I use this term for Batman specifically. I've always said he's a bulletproof character because you can get 66 and Dark Knight, and they both work, not just because it's of the time. There's just something about that mm-hmm. character that you can play him for comedy, you can play him for the most deadliest serious version, and it works. I don't actually I think you could put Spider-Man in any situation and he can work, but I don't know that you can just go, oh, this is the totally silly version, and then this is the super grim, dark version, and he would hold up. I actually don't know if that's true. Batman oddly is. Like, he works as a vessel for the reader in a different way. It's like a vessel versus a surrogate. I don't quite know how to explain the psychology, but they feel different to me, you know?
No, that's a good point. Because I do feel like even different iterations, you know, different universes, or even different characters, like when you're looking at like Miles or like Miguel O'Hara or Ben Reilly or Bendis's, you know, Teenage Peter and Ultimate, like they, even when you have different versions of the character, they all kind of need to adhere to like a certain, like, I don't know if it's tonal or if it's thematic, but yeah, it does seem as though with Spider-Man, there are certain ingredients that need to be there, or someone reading it is going to kind of cry foul and say, I'm no longer reading a Spider-Man book.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, oddly, like Superman, I think is that way, you know, and at least for me. And I know that this is something I never thought would have been controversial, but it did become controversial once, you know, he killed somebody in a movie. But it was like, you know, and I know he killed Zod, an old comic. I know that happened.
You've had this conversation before, I think.
Yeah, I've had this conversation before. I felt very sad about it. But it always, you know, anything that felt like cavalier about that was felt wrong to me. There was actually, I remember as a fan, like as a reader, there was some Elseworlds that had, and I don't know who wrote it. I just know that as a reader, when I read it, it felt wrong to me. And it was like old Superman and he had a giant gun on the cover. I don't remember it. It was a weird Elseworlds thing, but I just remember it feeling like that just doesn't feel like Superman. Like this idea that he had to get to that point where he had to shoot somebody felt weird. And whereas with Batman, we've seen images with him with a gun, and it's not like the Batman I would typically picture.
Yeah.
You know, but you could still make him work that way. It would still work, you know? And so it is interesting which characters can operate that way. You know, just as a footnote about Lorenzo, when he was doing the Batman show, you know, they were Time Magazine. I mean, that show was the most popular show on television. I mean, it was on every single day.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was crazy how popular it was overnight. And in the Time Magazine, like, cover story, you know, they've got Batman and why everybody loves him. And then in there, it's like the most hated man in America was Lorenzo. Like, it had its own article because all the comic fans were so pissed because they were getting, I think at the time, you know, the sort of Neil Adams, like, detective version.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, it was super realistic. So they were really pissed off. Like, that, the contradiction did not work for them. And, you know, it's funny that, you know, they both stood the test of time.
Yeah. It is funny, you know, as someone that's been reading Spider-Man comics since as long as I remember, weirdly started with like a random Stan Lee, John Romita issue. So kind of like, you know, I think a fairly classic look at Spider-Man, but I guess just because of the, when I was born and all the different versions that have always been around, to me, I never felt super wed to one version. But I was listening to a Grant Morrison interview the other day, and they were talking about how the comic book fans have struggled in recent years with having sort of won and also lost the culture wars, you know, within that very limited space. And specifically because, you know, I think a lot of us came to comics as sort of outsider nerds. And so you relate to some of these characters, Peter Parker especially. And I think that there's something about that you connect to. And then all of a sudden it's the biggest thing ever. And then, you know, now the MCU exists and it's the biggest thing ever and breaking all these records. And everyone's a fan of Captain America and all of this. And I feel sometimes there's a portion of the comic book fan community that I think struggles with that, like that exact feeling that comes, I think, when Batman 66 arrived, where it's not only that this is not reflective of what I view as the character, it's also that it's kind of being taken from me a bit and, right. and sort of, you know, wrested from my control.
Yeah, not I think to, that's, you know, I think that's completely fair. And it is a, and, you know, to a large degree, the fans who are really invested, I think that they had that reaction if a creative team takes the book in a direction they don't necessarily love too, right? I mean, it's not just across media. It can be within the book or across books or whatever. This guy gets it. This guy doesn't get it, you know, however people look at it. And I think it's a testament to how powerful the reading experience is. On the one hand too, you know, like it's,
yeah.
I mean, there are certain things that I read on an iPad, but most of my life I read comics, you know, in physical form.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that connection and that regular monthly or weekly, however often you would get books from the store, like that tactile connection really, I think, elevates our relationship with these characters, you know? And
yeah.
So then when it gets challenged, like what you're describing, where all of a sudden I don't like gatekeeping at all. I think I don't, you know, fans are welcome, period. Like I want there to be new fans, old fans, standard bearers, whatever. You want the old fans to be like, oh, you like Spidey? Cool. You should read Kraven's Last Hunt. That's an awesome story. You know, it's like you want that. I don't want the fans that are like, oh, you like Tom Holland? Well, you know, like that doesn't do me any good. Yeah. I don't think it does anybody any good, right? It's not a fun, and it's not in the clubhouse anymore. But it is that really visceral reaction we have to these characters that then when something changes, or even within ourselves, right, we grow and the characters don't because it's, you know, illusion of change, right? That's how you maintain a character for so long.
Yeah.
That can be frustrating. And it's kind of you have to, I think, as a reader, just go, well, do I want to stay on this train or do I want to just keep going back to the books I love? Because they exist, right? That's like the Alan Moore of it all, right? Where he's, every time a movie would come out, he'd be mad about. He eventually got to be like, just read the book. Like the book exists. And that's why he stopped finally getting mad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan, and that's a conversation that comes up often between the books and those movies, and it's always strange to me because one does not in any way negate the other. You know, it's not replacing, both continue to exist.
Right.
But we are, you know, the fun thing that we get to do as a Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast is, especially in you know, the years kind of since Endgame, and kind of in that period when Marvel Studios was on a break during COVID, there are a lot of people that wanted to come to the comics because they had gotten used to the rhythm of those movies coming out. And and then, you know, all these new projects were announced that were all kind of explicitly adapting certain comic runs or events. And so we've gotten to walk with a lot of folks that had never read comics ever. And in the last couple of years are now, you know, in our Discord reading stuff weekly, and now they have pull lists and
cool.
It's a fun thing for people to discover. And it's such a daunting thing for a lot of people because they're so afraid of getting it wrong somehow, you know, like reading the wrong thing or liking the wrong thing. And like, there's stuff that I originally liked that I had no idea, you know, they were these maligned runs that people view as, you know, like the low points of these series. And it's like, well, I'm glad that I didn't have the internet to tell me that I wasn't supposed to like that, because I did. And it may or may not still be my favorite thing. But it's a shame when that is. I do feel like there's a difference between the fandom and the gatekeeping. And
And you know, the funny thing about like something being a favorite, Steve Siegel always tells a story where he would, you know, he has a complicated relationship to Superman. You know, it's like he got to write Superman. He didn't necessarily love him as a character. He had, you know, his run was complicated for various reasons. And then he wound up writing It's a Bird, which was, you know, his Vertigo book about writing Superman and his specific relationship to Superman, and finding out that there was a genetic disease in his family and feeling very vulnerable while at the same time writing this invulnerable guy. Yeah, It's a Bird is amazing if you've never read it.
I haven't read it.
It's really spectacular. If you can find it, it's well worth it. But he was at a convention once and somebody came up and asked him to sign a book. And I don't remember if it was, I think it was a Superman book, but I could be wrong. And he was just like, oh, you know, I'm sorry, this is the one you've got, you know, but I'll sign it. Cause he was not a fan of the issue for whatever reason. And the person was like, this is like my favorite comic. Like really, they weren't, I won't go so far as to say they're a crestfallen, but it was like, they were stunned that that was his reaction, and he recovered quickly. And it's like, everything is somebody's favorite. Like, which is so, it's so wonderful. It's like, and I like to, you know, I get into my nerd arguments with my friends and my family about different things. Like, you like that one? What? That's so stupid. Or, you know, like my son, you know, and my nephews, we talk a lot about anime and manga, and, you know, I'll be into a character and they'll just be like, what is wrong with you? Like, he is terrible, you know, and it's partly just the perspective and age. But when it's, again, in the right spirit, it's fun. But they would never like crap on me for liking, you know, Denji and Chainsaw Man, right? I'm like, I kind of relate to him. And they're like, he's just horny and stupid. I'm like, yeah, well, I have been horny and stupid. I understand this character. I don't know why you guys are claiming you don't understand this character. And it was, you know, but it was very funny to me. So it is, I think there needs to be room for everybody to just go like, cool, like what you like. And you don't have to like crap on other people, you know? And the other thing is that you never know. There are things, there are gems that are hidden in there too. You know, that somebody, you know, just from my own experience of like Space Ghost, you know, it was like, I think if you look at Space Ghost on its face, you can go like, okay, it's just this sort of silly Hanna-Barbera cartoon from back in the day. I love that damn thing. And then when I had an opportunity to make, update it and do an adult version and make it dark, people are like, I had no idea Space Ghost was so cool, especially in the middle, because there had been the Adult Swim show, right? And he was just a goofball character. And I didn't do it to like counterbalance that. It was, if anything, I made sure I named him the same name that they use on the show, on Coast to Coast.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, let's have some continuity fun and be like, yeah, He was dark, and then he becomes the cartoon guy, and then he becomes the Adult Swim talk show host. Like, there's an arc. But there was room for both. And if people are just like, no, it's him being an idiot, interviewing people awkwardly, cool. And then if they come to my thing and they're like, oh my God, he's dark, you know, terrible Avenger. Like, great. You know, that's fine. It's fine.
No, I think, that to me feels like exactly the right way to handle, like what we were talking about earlier, like this kind of long and varied continuity stuff. And, you know, less so with a character like Space Ghost than with a character like Batman or Spider-Man. But it does make me curious. You've been a fan of Spider-Man for a long time. And, you know, we talked about the just kind of wild continuity there. Given that you were already, you know, you were familiar as a fan, but then also, you know, you had written parts of the story, you know, kind of on and off for the last, you know, 15 years. When you got the gig to start a new volume here, which is different from Eight Deaths, in that Eight Deaths feels a lot more self-contained. It's Amazing Spider-Man, obviously, but you're not dealing as much with like the classic villains or a ton on some with his history there in some very meaningful ways, but not necessarily having to mind the continuity per se.
Right.
Did you find yourself like needing to or wanting to do any kind of homework? Did you go back and read the runs?
Absolutely. Like, and I will typically go as far back as I can sort of stomach on a character and look at a bunch of stuff. I don't do the like, oh, I'm going to read every single thing that was ever written.
Right.
Because that way lies madness. I mean, it's like, then you get 60 years of ideas and go, oh, now what do I do? You know?
Yeah.
Because there is good and bad and everything. But I go back, I looked at, you know, read up to basically Death of Gwen Stacy, you know, just to sort of get into that land again and go, why did this work? Why did this take off? Why do, you know, and it's all the same stuff that we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. It's the soap opera. It's the regular life. It's worrying about Aunt May. Oh, I got a cold while I'm fighting the rhino or whatever. Like, it's all that great stuff. Making some discoveries there too, which is how angry Peter was all the time, which was a bit of a discovery for me. Cause I think that because of the other media, especially because of cartoons, we're sort of programmed to remember Peter, misremember him as like, oh, he was a nerd who got stuffed in lockers by Flash Thompson, who he didn't really hang out with until much later.
Yeah.
And it was like, no, like he was mad a lot. Like he would storm out of like the coffee bean, you know, just because Mary Jane looked at Flash or something. Like, it was hilarious. So that was useful to go back and look at that. And then it's kind of without doing too much of a deep dive into the stuff that I loved, it's just spending a little bit of time going, why is Kraven's Last Hunt so important to me? And why was it so seminal in my understanding of Spider-Man and the other, you know, stories that I did get to work on and why I felt they worked. But, you know, just these, I try to go back to the time when I was honestly like the biggest fan. And then, you know, so that was a period of time where I was buying and reading the books when I was much younger. And then there was sort of like the movies came out, you know, and then it was, well, what did I like about the movies? What didn't I like about the movies? And it just kind of helps distill like, all right, what is the DNA? And then where does that now bounce off of me? Like as the writer I am today. Right.
Yeah.
Because it can't all just be nostalgia. For me, that doesn't work. I think for some people it can work. But for me, it can't just be nostalgia. It can't just be like the vibes of when I was a kid. But it's what works, apply craft to that, and then try to, you know, kick off something new. And it's daunting because there is a lot, you know, like there are a lot of types of stories that I want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really like to have sort of this tapestry of subplots and overplots and things that all weave together. And when you sort of wait, however long I get on this thing, that you get to go, oh yeah, he figured out a lot of stuff. like up right up top that's paying off 30 issues later. You know, like in a perfect world, I would love to do that. And that can be a little daunting because it's just the type of planning, you know, that takes. But then you can look back at some of these old issues and go like, oh yeah, in my head, this thing was like a saga. And then you go, oh no, it was 5 issues. Like, yeah, they just got it done so quickly. Or it's like, oh, the introduction of a character, they were so mysterious. And it's like, no, they just threw somebody in shadow and just kept talking about them. And then they showed up. Like, it wasn't really a mystery, right?
Yeah,
it's a fake mystery. So that takes a little pressure off.
Well, I think I was listening to an interview with Jerry Conway the other day, and he was talking about how back when he worked with Stan, that one of Stan's tricks, he was writing so many books at the time, obviously, like all of them, at one point, that he would leave himself clues in past issues. So he would remember which plot threads to follow up on. And there is something kind of comforting about that, you know, like these issues that we view as the Bible of Spider-Man, you know, as like the perfect distillation. You know, like setting aside the fact that, you know, he called him by the wrong name for the first issue. It's also, you know, it's kind of, there is something, it at that point, they didn't have the privilege of sitting back and like plotting out this whole thing for years down the line. And
no, they're coming from the tradition of pulp writers. I mean, it's quite literally the same job, right? It's just like, how many words can I crank out in how short a period of time? Because the book has to be printed.
Yeah.
The end, right? And so it's just like, they're just running and gunning. And obviously to a much lesser degree, because I'm not writing however many titles Stan was writing at the time. But it's like, you know, shipping twice a month, is, you know, okay, it's 2 comic books a month. It's not hard to physically write that. Like, that's not a ton of physical writing. But to plot it out and make sure the train is moving, you're having a good time. And, you know, you have to be willing to be a little bit looser than I typically am. You know, I do like to plot everything out to the best of my ability. Usually we would plot things like a year at a time. You know, it was just a good number for everybody. Mm-hmm. Years, 24 issues. Like, that's a lot of issues.
And you write full script, right?
I write full script. Yeah.
Yeah. So
sometimes I wish I did not. But I just can't not. It doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah.
It feels like I'm not doing the job. And with any artist, I'm always like, I don't care if you want to change stuff. Like, I don't write like, oh, my word is law. It's just, this is how I do it. So if it's helpful, cool. You know, like my stuff looks like a movie script. I don't write panel 1, panel 2 even. It's just sort of, it's implied because of the way it's broken down. But if it's like, hey, you've got a better way to do this, knock yourself out. And a lot of times I get choreography questions from artists and they're like, this doesn't quite work. Can I do this? I'm like, as long as I didn't lose X, I need X to happen. However you get there, I don't care. You know, and that's fun. That's the guy who first got me into comics would really describe it as jazz. I mean, like that's the jazz part, you know, where it's just like you set a baseline out and then the artist is playing sax and then the drummer kicks in. You're like, cool, I can freak out and go, that's not how it should be done. This is what I wrote. Or you shift your baseline and you figure it out. You know, that is the fun part of working at that rate of speed.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I'm always preaching about, you know, when I'm trying to get people to read more comics. I think there are so many, you know, obviously across all these different forms of media that we have, we've got like some of the best television coming out right now. And I feel like a lot of really great films. But I feel like one thing that's really unique about comics, it still takes a lot of time and obviously takes a lot of money to make these, but you still, relatively speaking, are boiling it down to a couple of creators that are really speaking into it, you know, rather than, you know, dozens or hundreds when you're dealing with some of these massive productions. And so it really does feel like this kind of, I'm sure it varies depending on relationships, but the like almost alchemical, you know, result of of Joe plus Ed, or you know, Joe plus Pepe, or JRJR, which I think, like, I mean, that's a fascinating contrast there. I mean, first off, I think you might have one of the best Spider-Man art teams, like, this side of Y2K.
It's, yeah, it's insane. Yeah, I keep describing it as an embarrassment of riches, and I don't know any other words for it. I mean, it's just preposterous.
It's, but it's also, you know, I don't, it's tricky sometimes because I like on certain books for there to feel like there's a continuity, like artistically, you know, you want it to feel similarly. And this is one where, you know, just based on the first issue, and, you know, I'm very familiar. JRJR is one of my favorite artists. Sure. So I'm familiar with his style in Spider-Man, but it's weirdly complementary where, like, he and Pepe just have such different strengths that I love it. It's like you get everything that you would want, like all of the, like, there's something really, they're cinematic in very different ways, I guess.
Sure.
And it's hard to describe. Like, I always feel like JRJR is so underrated for his pacing and for the way that he structures out scenes like he's like a storyboard artist or something.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
And it's, he's so, like, the moves.
Master storyteller. I mean, they both are. But, like, you know, in the Venn diagram of where they overlap and where they differ, obviously, you know, especially at a glance, right? You go, oh, these so different.
Mm-hmm.
But what, you know, acting, like the way characters like emote,
yeah,
that not everybody pulls that off. And you sort of go, well, that's sort of what, isn't that one of the most important things in comics? It's like, well, a lot of times you're drawing people in masks and it's about the action and the spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't sell the acting in those quieter scenes, especially in Spider-Man, you don't get anywhere. And they both do it exquisitely, just in different ways, right? And then, like you said, the storytelling, the actual, like, sequential storytelling,
mm-hmm.
they're both, you know, masters of that craft, and they'll pick different approaches, you know, but it's like, you know, pick your two favorite directors that are really different. It's just they'll overlap. Maybe they're both influenced by, you know, Hitchcock, and mm-hmm. one of them turns out to be Spielberg and one is Bong Joon-ho or something. It's like they're, you know, you can go, like, yeah, these guys, they know exactly what they're doing. Every line's intentional. But yeah, it's that heart that comes through, you know, and
yeah,
you know, Pepe draws these incredible fight sequences.
Oh my gosh.
You know, that are, and you're going to see some stuff that are like, it's like, really insane what's coming down the pike, but a JR Jr. punch, I feel like, literally,
yeah,
you feel it jump the off weight, the page.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, it was such a perfect, like, the Norman Osborn scene at the end of that first issue, which I won't describe too much in case folks haven't picked it up yet, but you know, the punch is there. Like, you feel like the crunching of the metal, you know, it's like,
mm-hmm.
But
yeah, there's it's like he's got gravity, like, instead of lead in his pencil.
Yeah. You know,
it's just like it's really cool. And that's been consistent, right? Like, since I can remember, all the various iterations of him and, you know, reading him as a fan and now getting to work with him. I mean, it's spectacular.
It is. I mean, I was so excited to see him coming onto the book with Zeb regularly was so exciting for me at the time. And I didn't know if he was going to be leaving with Zeb. So I was really excited to see him coming back just because, I mean, the final Tombstone fight that he illustrated there was just,
that was great.
On, I mean, again, a comic that obviously, you know, Zeb plotted and there was dialogue in there, but that feels like it was just, you know, let JRJR cook, you know,
and let him off the chain. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
But I have just been, I emailed you this, like, I, you know, I'm looking at this, like, splash page with Rhino, and obviously that's all of that stuff, the action, from Pepe and the first two issues has been incredible. But to your point, yeah, like some of the, you know, the very opening scenes here with the panels flipping back and forth from Peter's interview to kind of what he's thinking about based on the questions, which I know had to be the way that you scripted that out.
Right.
And the pacing on that is so well done from your perspective, and was such a fantastic way to start the issue and to kind of root it back in Peter. But also, yeah, to your point about his abilities kind of as an actor there, like it reminds me a bit of, you know, some of my favorite comics ever are Bendis's Ultimate Spider-Man, especially the first chunk of that run. And Bagley was a huge part of what drew me to it. And I loved his action. I loved his Spider-Man. But I feel like the thing that made that book work is so much of it was just Bagley doing panels of just a person's face.
Right.
You know, being like laughing or disappointed or angry. And it was just shots of that stuff over and over again. And you wouldn't think of that as great superhero comic art. But yeah, to your point, like that's the thing that gives it heart and that makes it connect. And yeah, I didn't know how well Pepe would do on something like that, but it is it's a delight, I think, to see both ends of that spectrum.
Sure. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm embarrassed to admit that I didn't know Pepe's work very well before I started, you know, before I found out he was going to, I knew a little bit before he got the book, because I remember thinking when they said I was going to get to do it, I didn't say it out loud because you don't always get to have a say in these things. And I figured they've already got somebody on deck for Spidey. But in my mind, I was like, man, that Pepe guy, I wish we could get him. Wow. And then they got him without my saying anything. And I was like, oh my God, you're kidding me. And I had just met him in person a few months before, because it turns out that he and Ken Nomura went to school together. So they've known each other for years. And so we were in Europe promoting Immortal Sergeant, and Pepe ran a panel for us at a comic book store. He had a nice event. And
oh, that's so fun.
It was so cool. So that was how I met him. And Ken was like, oh, Pepe's very good. I was like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, he's kind of like the top guy right now. You should maybe know who he is. And I was embarrassed because I didn't really know his work. And I looked and I was like, oh yeah, he's really cool. And then it was once he started handing in, you know, layouts and sketches, he's somebody that will really bleed to try to figure out how to make what's in my brain work, you know? And if something doesn't, then he'll be like, listen, I tried. What do we do? And then we always figure it out. But he's a master. And you'll see as we get into this, you know, the mechanism of the flashbacks to Peter in middle school is something I really like. And I'm hoping I will be able to maintain a sort of a signature element of things, you know, within the run. Cause I just love it so much. And I love seeing these characters grounded in their youth. Right.
Like
and especially a youth we really haven't looked at, you know, if I took them back to high school, then it's like continuity cop time, and that's going to be bad.
And what are you going to do there that hasn't
been? Yeah, what am I going to do? Exactly. I'm going to try to compete with those guys. Like, come on. But this is, it was sort of untapped territory. And for me, also very formative time, you know, for, I think, psychologically for a character. So when you see what we get to in sort of like, by the time we get to four, like there are scenes in four, like, you know, that I hope bring people to tears. Cause it's,
I mean,
it's good stuff.
It's our, I mean, even I think it was issue two, but the scene with Peter and Aunt May and Uncle Ben fighting, you know, is even that it tugs at your heartstrings some, because it's like, you know, and it's hitting on something that, you know, you got a little bit of in like the first Raimi film, where they kind of they retool the final moments with Uncle Ben to be even more painful, which I think also it has some roots in Bendis's Ultimate Spider-Man. But I do think that, I love the idea of the middle school Peter. One, I love the visual of the first shot you get of broken glasses and like the smile, the jagged smile. I mean, it's like that. I don't know if that's what was in your head, or how much that kind of altered your, you know, how you were envisioning those sequences. But it's such like it's an immediately recognizable version of Peter that is not, to your point, a version that we've ever seen before. Like, you know, you see Peter in the sweater vest, right, and you're like, oh, high school Peter Parker, you know, like, yeah, that's the kind of easy trick. But this doesn't look like that Peter, and it shouldn't, but it feels like it's got the characteristics of a modern Peter, you know, an adult Peter Parker, but it's drawing on this thing that you noted earlier, seeing in those early issues. Like, there is the, you know, kind of Billy Joel angry young man thing, right, going on there. Like, he was mad all the time. I mean, the whole origin story is kind of him being a, like, not,
yeah,
kind person,
not the best. Peter's not the best, and that, you know, looking back at that stuff, it's like, well, I think there are reasons for that. And I don't think that the reason, I mean, certainly I think when he was cooked up, I'm sure that it was just like, Stan was like, yeah, teenagers are punks. Let's all be punks. You know, right? I mean, Stan was younger than I am now when he did it, but it's like, it was just that there's sort of like, yeah, I'm looking at attitude, right? And it becomes shorthand for, I have to compress an entire lifetime into a quick series of events so that you can get to the death of Uncle Ben. Right. But the looking at that in a younger character starts to beg questions. Like, really, what are you mad about when you're 12, you know, and what does that really come from? Which we get to, you know, in this arc.
Hmm.
And that stuff wound up laying the groundwork for some of the big themes that hopefully we're going to get to play with throughout the whole run. And, you know, it's not loss necessarily, but the fear of loss, which is something I realize that I'm obsessed with because I've written about it a bunch of times in my career. You know, like, loss is painful, but fear is more painful to me. And I think it can drive people into different, you know, situations that they wouldn't necessarily want to take when they were sort of more, you know, more thoughtful. And then there's just also the element of looking at a character at that age. I feel like, and this is partly my own, this is definitely from my own experience, middle school was very challenging. I think middle school is really challenging for a lot of people. High school, I feel like you're aware of the striations and like, okay, am I a gazelle or am I a lion? And I'm going to figure this out. Even if you navigate those things and you evolve and change as you go, you're aware of them. I think nobody knows what the hell is happening in middle school because it's like, it's utter chaos and your body's going through utter chaos at the same time. So it's all bets are off. And in some ways you're almost like a pure version of who you're going to become later. Now that stuff obviously gets hammered and chiseled and whatever by life, but there are these points that I know they talk about in psychology of sort of where you advance and your brain chemistry essentially changes. That's one of the big ones, is that period of time. Because puberty, man.
Oh, man. I mean, well, it's like the all of the worst ingredients where it's like you have, I mean, I don't think anyone can be as mean as middle schoolers, but also no, like you're never as awkward and like you're never as perfect prey as you are when you're in middle school. So it's
so
like
true.
You're just true. I mean, oh man, I was tall. Well, I became tall in high school. So in junior high, I was just like a freak, you know, with like massive hands and feet that couldn't catch anything. And that's a whole, you know, yeah, there's all this stuff built in. And a lot of it is this fear, and you don't really know. In high school, you know how to cover that up, and you know how to like put on a costume a little bit, right, and pretend to be what you think people need or want so that you can be attractive to various groups of people or to adults. You know, I think it's easier to kind of put on the I'm a grown-up voice. But yeah, I think as a 12-year-old, you don't even know yet the language to use. So it is so raw.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And so that hitting on that became really fun. And you know, and then there's obviously a rich history of sort of stories that are very formative. You know, I think for a lot of us, kind of, I don't think it really matters what generation you're from. It's like people get what Stand By Me means. You know what I mean? It's like you sort of see that time and what that, not the literal time period of the movie, but that age.
Right.
And sort of like, or if you talk to people, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who would be like, oh yeah, when I was 12 and I did X, Y, and Z. And you're like, you did that stuff at 12? Like, you know, like it was a time of like, you just don't know what the rules are because they don't really exist, you know, and you're pressing boundaries for the first time to see what happens. And it's just very cool. And again, Pepe in those scenes, oh my God, it's just like, he does a thing. Four is probably my favorite issue of the run for a lot of reasons so far, you know, just because I've seen it complete. But he pulls off some storytelling tricks that are outstanding. Like there's a spread that I think is, to me, is groundbreaking, but it's like, it's all about that emotional stuff churning up and yet at the same time dealing with Spidey in action. It's so sick. I can't wait for people to see it. Like I really, you know, I've said from the beginning, like people can, they're going to lock and load and take shots at the story. Knock yourself out. You cannot criticize how this book looks. It is above reproach. Pepe is like so good. And Martha is so good. Like the two of them together as a team. Oh my God. They just, and it's so fun to watch them just bounce back and forth, how they work and talk, how they talk about color and what it does. They're so focused on composition and you know, what does it mean when you put this highlight here as opposed to over there? Like they're just masters. It's the sort of stuff that you go like, oh, this is fun. Like this is what it means to be in a creative field with creative humans. Like it's just, I don't know. I find it really inspiring.
Oh man. I mean, the colors in these issues really are, I'm glad you pointed that out. Cause it is, that's a big part of it. Like it's immaculate. And that's one of the coloring is one of those things that's so hard for me to put my finger on. And in the last couple of years, I've tried to pay more attention to the colorist that I like. It's especially, it's not often that I'm like, I dislike this colorist,
right?
But I know the ones that really work for whatever reason. And that is almost like my wife's a graphic designer and she always tells me that what I do, writing legal briefs feels like I'm like, it's magic because she has no idea how, how any of those words make sense. But to me, it's so much more, you know, she like has an idea and then, you know, she does a lot of illustration and hand drawn stuff. And it's just like, I have no sense of how you get from something in your head to that in general, especially because she does a lot of like design elements around all that. And so there's more than just the drawing a thing, but the coloring in comics, like I don't even know where you would begin with finding just the right balance on that stuff, because there are some colorists that I love and I'll read a comic with them and I realize that it doesn't quite click for me like it has with another artist, and I never know if that's the subject matter or the artist or just the whole thing. But yeah, this is one where it's just like, I mean, this book in general, Joe, I mean, I emailed you. It is one of the, I think it, I mean, it's the strongest opening issue of a new run of Amazing Spider-Man that I remember reading. You know, like I'm trying to think back.
Oh, thank you.
It all works so well. Like it feels like finely tuned, but it's got that heart under it. You know, it's not just technically great. It is, but it feels like all of you are legitimately putting yourselves into this. And so to hear you talk about
it, I'm very glad to hear that. Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that because it's true. I mean, you know, all the conversations I've had with everybody, it's everybody really, you know, we do love this character. We love this book. We just want it to be the most fun for everybody. You know, we want to have fun. We want you guys to have fun. Like, we want to do right by the character. You know, we're very well aware that there's anniversaries are coming up. I mean, we're right around the corner from, you know, 975, and then it's 1,000, you know, which hopefully I'll be around, you know, on the book at 1,000, which is just the craziest thing, you know? And so there's that sense of responsibility is really there. And yeah, I feel like people are firing on all cylinders. It's just been great.
Yeah. I hope that that's the case, because this is the team that I've thought about that a lot in recent years as we've gotten an inch closer to 1,000. You know, what would my dream team be in that situation? Because there are so many writers and artists that I've really loved on the book over the last 15, 20 years that could ostensibly work on it. And I haven't really, I mean, this is the first time that there's a team where, you know, if y'all are continuing to work together in the way that you have, including with John Romita Jr., that's everything that I think we could ask for as readers. So I,
well, you know, I hope so.
I'm very excited. My last question for you, and I'll let you go, is, you know, you've talked about some of these issues that you have coming, or that you've seen in full. Obviously the book is shipping, you know, twice a month, and that is a lot for any one artist to do. I do know, you know, John Romita Jr., he calls it deadline style, the way that his art has evolved over the years, which I love, but I don't know if that makes it easier for one or the other to move more quickly. But I was curious, because they have such distinct styles, whenever it comes to picking an artist for an arc, is that all through Nick's office, or is that something that you kind of get to speak into with John and Pepe?
Yeah, I'm definitely aware of what the schedule is ahead of time. And it's funny. I used to say that I don't adjust the writing for the artist. I do a little bit, you know, up top. Mm-hmm. But this is such a unique beast that you kind of have to. Like, they like different things. They have different styles.
Yeah.
Different strengths, you know, et cetera. With, again, that Venn diagram, the stuff they both do great, I never have to worry about. So it's not like I'm changing things a lot. And I've been proving myself wrong sometimes too. Like, you know, I keep telling this story about how I wanted to give Johnny like a double page spread, like, you know, big moment, you know, thing. And he's like, hey, would you care if I made it a splash and put a, you know, storytelling page instead? And I was like, yeah, sure, if you want to. He gave me like a 9-panel page, which I would not have expected.
Yeah.
You know, and I would have felt bad if I wrote him a 9-panel page, you know, because I would have thought he liked the bigger images. And then I was like, oh, all right, great. Well, now I know I can write you 9-panel pages.
Yeah.
You know, and so you learn that as you go. And we're doing some pretty fun gymnastics, I think, certainly in this first, so far, how am I through half a year, but it'll bring us through, you know, to the whole year. And then,
you're far ahead.
Right now I'm 6 months ahead, I think, total, which is great, but because of the way people leapfrog, that doesn't totally mean anything, you know, but it's fine. And yeah, I mean, the farther ahead I can be, the better. Yeah. I mean, you know, cause it just makes me stress less, you know, cause you just know they're nipping your heels. And then if something comes up or somebody gets sick or, you know, all of a sudden I want to go on vacation or whatever, like, life gets in the way, you know, but yeah, it's been cool. I'm definitely involved. I definitely go, okay, who would be better for blank?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it would be cooler for Pepe on this one. I think it's cooler for Johnny on this one. So we definitely get to talk about it. And then, just by virtue of sort of the chaos of schedules and, you know, holidays and whatever, you know, Johnny has just started getting more caught up, to where I, you know, like where I'm at, not, not like he's that far ahead, but it's just where now I'm really seeing like, here's a complete issue. Cool. Like now I'm looking, this is what I wrote. This is what I got, you know, cause he did that, the Godzilla FF book. So, which was super fun. Yeah. So, okay, you know, that kind of didn't take him off the board, but it's just, I have more backlog of Pepe than I do of Johnny. So now as I'm starting to see it and I get to see like, okay, this is how he interprets the stuff I do and whatever. I'll definitely be making adjustments going forward because it'll make more sense, you know? And that's the sort of stuff that like nobody would know or even, you know, I have time that if I had to tweak scripts, I can, but it's like, that may be the sort of thing that really reveals itself 6 months down the line, you know, where you start to see the adjustment period. But you know, they're, everybody's communicative, which is great. And they're just such great guys to work with. And it's been a real pleasure and a real joy and an honor. So, you know, I think this spirit for me, at least, you know, the spirit of just going into this is like, all right, we have locked arms and let's just have a good time. You know, has been coming through.
Well, it does. I mean, I that makes sense because, you know, we've talked about the stuff from Pepe and John that worked so well in that first issue with like the Norman fight there at the end. But also, you know, I don't know if the plan was always for him to introduce this new villain at the at the end of the first. But I mean, that talk about like a John Romita Jr. like. It,
totally.
Just the weight of it, you know, like that is, it's like the feels carved onto the page.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, he definitely gets, you know, the Hellgate introduction is JR Jr. And that, it's, you know, it's going to be sick. Like, I can't wait, you know, to have those things in front of me because I know it's going to be like insane. You know, like it's going to be, and, you know, and Pepe's version would have been insane too.
Right.
But it's, the construction of that character was like, oh no, this is going to be a great, you know, Johnny. Yeah. Miller. So, you know,
and there's something really fun about letting Pepe kind of do these massive, like, you know, the last page of the, and I guess the bulk of the first issue when he turns and sees all, you know, all these villains from across the, and you know, it's fun seeing for fans of the comic, longtime fans, seeing some recent villains, some classic villains, a lot of classic villains, obviously, but it's kind of fun to have an artist that's newer to Spider-Man. Every artist is newer to Spider-Man than John Romita Jr. at this point. Get to like put a spin on all these old characters and then kind of let John come in and do something that feels so new and fresh. It's like it's not necessarily what you would expect,
right?
When you see those two names on the book, so it makes sense that there's some intentionality there.
Yeah, and again, it is the tightrope walk of you know, whether you think of it as older versus newer or classic versus modern or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's going how do you mess with expectations, but in a way that it doesn't feel arbitrary and feels good for the character and good for the book, and certainly with the art duties, that's what we've tried to do. And, and those guys are killing it. So it's a good time. And I just hope people like it. You know, I mean, I hope people are along for the ride and they, give it a shot.
You're killing it as well. We've talked a lot about the art here. But know that, I mean, I think the entire approach for a character that's so rooted in these adolescent, like the whole maturity versus immaturity. I mean, looking at the stuff that Stan Lee explored and Roger Stern explored and the juxtaposition of Peter and Norman Osborn and Peter and Adrian Toomes and all these different, like, what is it that makes Spider-Man different from Batman or Superman? And what is the kind of angst there? I think the way that you're going at that with this middle school approach is, it's one of those things that feels so natural that I can't believe no one's done it before, which is, I feel like, always the sign that you're onto something special. So I am legitimately so glad that we were able to have you back on to talk about it, because I had high hopes when I opened up that first issue a couple weeks ago, and my expectations were very much exceeded. So I
thank you.
This was a pleasure, and I appreciate you giving us so much of your time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it too. And yeah, thanks. I hope, I'll keep doing it as long as you guys keep reading it.
Yeah, if you keep doing it, I'll keep buying it. We'll do that.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.